They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Hello, this is William Held. Thank you for listening to the Necessary and Proper podcast. On April 11th, the Article 1 Initiative was pleased to partner with the Federalist Society's University of Kentucky College of Law student chapter to host Congressman Andy Barr of Kentucky's 6th Congressional District. Congressman Barr's remarks focus on the arguments for and against the legality of the recent declaration by the President of a national emergency on our nation's southern border. We hope you'll enjoy.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you very much to the UK College of Law Federal Society chapter. It's great to be with you. As Tom pointed out, I was once the chapter president, and I really treasure my experience as a member of the Federal Society, not just as a student and traveling to the student Federal Society conferences, but also in the Young Lawyers Division. And I want to thank Tom for serving in that capacity, representing the young lawyers in the Federal Society. Chaz English, thank you for your leadership and for your invitation. I did get a chance to briefly visit with Dean David Brennan. Thank you for your support of the College of Law, your leadership of the College of Law, and also for your support of student societies like the Federalist Society. And of course, my good friend Paul Salamanca, who taught me constitutional law and federal courts when I was in law school, but has since then become much more than a former professor, a mentor, a friend, and really a conscience of legal conservatism and originalism, and he's taught me a whole lot. And for that, I will treasure that always. Thank you, Paul. As you may have seen in the news recently, I have developed a friendship with a new freshman member of Congress from the Bronx, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I mean that. I hope to cultivate a friendship with our new socialist colleague. I have, as you may have read, invited Ms. Cortez to a coal mine. But as I sat here listening to leadership of the Federalist Society of UK and the young lawyers here in Kentucky, I realized I made a mistake. If I was attempting to impart some wisdom on my colleague, I should have invited her to a meeting of the Federalist Society. I think we would have gotten a lot more out of that. So let me give a little talk about something that's been in the news recently, and that is the President's emergency declaration related to the southern border. Immigration is a hot topic. It is a hot topic from a national security policy point of view. It's a hot topic from the standpoint of immigration law. We are a nation of immigrants. We are also a nation of laws. But tonight I want to focus on the legal ramifications of the decision and the constitutional perspectives that are implicated in this debate. As members of the Federalist Society, we believe in the original meaning of the Constitution. That means we believe in the criticality and the centrality of the separation of powers, the idea embedded in our foundational law that no one branch of the federal government may encroach upon the powers given to another branch. It also means that we believe, just as the late Justice Antonin Scalia believed, that the structure of the Constitution, separation of powers, and federalism are even more important than the Bill of Rights in terms of safeguarding individual liberty. Scalia was an originalist, not a strict constructionist, an interpretive philosophy with which he is often wrongly associated. In his book on interpreting legal texts, A Matter of Interpretation, Justice Scalia himself said in no uncertain terms, quote, I am not a strict constructionist, and no one ought to be. He continued, a text should not be construed strictly, and it should not be construed leniently. It should be construed reasonably to contain all that it fairly means, unquote. Scalia wrote with Brian Garner that strict constructionism understood as a judicial straitjacket is a long outmoded approach deriving from a mistrust of all enacted law. He implied that the theory acts to limit one to the hyper-literal meaning of each word of the text, to the exclusion of considering the full body of the text, which often contains implications that can alter the literal meaning of individual words. For these reasons, Justice Scalia insisted that strict constructionism, as opposed to fair reading textualism, is not a doctrine to be taken seriously. I will return to this later. When thinking about Congress's role in the constitutional system, probably every member of Congress can share an anecdote similar to the following. The other day, a constituent asked me to help her with a municipal trash cleanup issue in her neighborhood. I responded, you know, that is a very important issue, but I'm your federal representative in the United States Congress. That is a non-federal issue, but I would be happy to put you in touch with your local city council member. And she said, yeah, I know. I just thought I'd start at the bottom and work my way up to the top. Now, there's some truth to that. And it's not just because Congress is so often a punchline. In many respects, Congress today is the weakest of the three branches in our constitutional system, because for the last 85 years, Congress has delegated away much of its lawmaking authority to unelected bureaucrats in the executive branch. As originalists, we should all see this as a problem. I would argue a serious problem, since the framers envisioned the three separate branches of the federal government competing with one another, zealously guarding their powers, and even more than the Bill of Rights, checking the other branches to preserve and protect individual liberty. We often hear reference to co-equal branches. That goes too far, however, as the Federalist Papers are contemporaneous evidence that the framers believed that the legislative branch would be the strongest and the judicial branch would be the weakest branch in the federal government. And this is even more reason to be alarmed at the atrophying legislative authority we have witnessed in recent decades. Today, with the rise of the bureaucracy and activist judges, we might argue that the executive is the strongest and Congress is the weakest of all the branches. In any event, the framers gave each branch the tools to compete with each other, but did not necessarily guarantee co-equal outcomes in all interbranch disputes. Still, an original understanding of the Constitution reveals an expectation of robust checks and balances. Consider the words of Madison in Federalist Number 51. But the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. The provision for defense must be in this, as in all other cases, be made commensurate to the danger of attack. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interests of the man must be connected to the constitutional rights of the place. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections of human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is no doubt the primary control on the government. But experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. And that birthed the separation of powers. Of all the enumerated powers that the legislative branch must zealously protect most of all, I believe, as a member of Congress with 6 years under my belt, the most important is the power of the purse. Article 1, Section 9 clearly provides that no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. This means that no other branch, not the executive, not the judicial, no other branch may appropriate funds. I take this section of Article 1 seriously. Madison, again, in Federalist Number 58, quote, "The power over the purse may in fact be regarded as the most complete and effectual weapon with which any constitution can arm the immediate representatives of the people for obtaining a redress of every grievance and for carrying into effect every just and salutary measure." In the course of my work on the House Financial Services Committee, I have vigorously defended congressional authority over appropriations, having introduced a bill that I call the Taking Account of Bureaucrats Spending Act, or TABS Act, keeping tabs on the bureaucrats, a bill to subject the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to the annual appropriations process, replacing the opaque formula of funding that agency by the Federal Reserve established in the Dodd-Frank Act. I have also co-sponsored and on multiple occasions voted in favor of the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act, or the REINS Act, pull the reins in on the bureaucracy, to reinvigorate the non-delegation doctrine. Do you remember when Professor Salamanca taught you the non-delegation doctrine and how that doctrine has decayed over the last several decades? Given all of this, given that I'm speaking to a room of originalists, presumably, as an originalist, to the Federalist Society as a former member and president of this chapter of the Federalist Society, as a member of Congress, whose foremost job, I would argue, is to zealously guard the legislative powers of Congress for Congress, and as a member of Congress whose legislative record, I would argue, includes advocacy to restore to Congress the power of the purse and to rebalance the relationship between the legislative and executive branches consistent with the non-delegation doctrine, I now endeavor, Joe, to craft an argument that may at first glance appear to be inconsistent with that point of view. Namely, that President Trump's declaration of a national emergency concerning the southern border and his unilateral executive action to access Department of Defense military construction funds to support the construction of a southern border wall system is in fact lawful and constitutional. Now, I am mindful that some of my Republican colleagues in both the House and the Senate joined with Democrats in voting in favor of a resolution to terminate the President's emergency declaration, citing the structure and the original meaning of the Constitution, the separation of powers, and arguing that the President's action represents a continuation of Congress's long-standing and disappointing record of abdicating its exclusive authority over appropriations and frittering away its Article I powers to an ever-expanding executive branch. I take seriously their arguments and I share their concerns, but I disagree. I disagree that President Trump's emergency declaration is unconstitutional, and I disagree that it violates the separation of powers. In fact, I believe that the original meaning of Article 1 and Article 2 support the President's action in this case, and I believe that the outcome to date has been the right outcome, namely, the fact that the House failed to override the President's veto of the resolution terminating his declaration, an override measure on which I voted no. In fact, I disagree so much with my colleagues who voted to terminate the President's declaration and override his veto that I raised the issue in the Oval Office with the Commander-in-Chief himself. He was very enthusiastic. In fact, when I told him that I supported his position, and I told him that I believed his position was grounded in both statutory and constitutional law, he turned to his acting chief of staff, my former colleague Mick Mulvaney, and said, Mick, go get the White House counsel. So the White House counsel came in and we started talking. And so I filed just this last week an amicus brief in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia in the case of Alvarez et al. Versus Trump et al. I argued in that brief that the National Emergencies Act provided the president with unfettered discretion, Congress with oversight, and private parties with no role or standing to challenge the exercise of that discretion. I intend to lead similar amicus efforts in support of the president's declaration in other cases sure to follow. Now, in support of my position, which may be controversial in this room, let me give you a roadmap of the remainder of my talk for tonight. First, I will make the argument that the situation on the southern border is a national emergency and that the president has the authority to declare it so. Second, I will point out that Congress has lawfully, even if ill-advisedly, delegated the authority to declare this emergency and reprogram unobligated funds already appropriated for military construction. Third, I will distinguish this case from executive action by President Truman, especially his unconstitutional action in Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company versus Sawyer. Fourth, I will distinguish this case of executive action from President Obama's unconstitutional actions in the unilateral DACA-DAPA executive orders. And finally, I will offer a better alternative to reclaiming legislative authority for Congress, reinvigorating the separation of powers, than voting to terminate the president's emergency declaration in this case, as some of my colleagues did. First, the crisis on the southern border is a national emergency, and in my view, President Trump has the legal authority to declare it so. This is a national emergency. New data from the Department of Homeland Security shows that more than 76,000 inadmissible aliens arrived at the southern border in February alone. A recent meeting with the Department of Homeland Security officials revealed to me and other members of Congress that an average of more than 4,000 aliens cross illegally every day at the southern border. Border Patrol reports to Congress that there has been a 97% increase in apprehensions related to individuals crossing illegally over the same period in the previous year. In this fiscal year to date, there have been more than 300% increase in the number of family units apprehended compared to the same period last fiscal year. Many migrants who make the trek through Central America and Mexico encounter horrific violence, including sexual assault. One-third of women are sexually abused along the journey to the border, according to Doctors Without Borders. Dangerous criminals have exploited our porous borders to gain entry to the country. In the last 2 years alone, ICE has made 266,000 arrests of illegal immigrants with criminal records, many charged with violent crimes. Deadly drugs continue to pour across our border into our communities, including the vast majority of cocaine and heroin consumed in America. 90% of the heroin that is interdicted along the southern border of the United States. CBP seized 895,000 pounds of drugs at the border last fiscal year. Border Patrol seized 2,135 pounds of deadly fentanyl in fiscal year 2018. Enough, now listen to this, enough for 484 million lethal doses. That equals a lethal dose for more than the entire U.S. population. And Customs and Border Protection seized more drugs between the ports of entry than at the ports of entry. More than 70,000 American lives were lost to drug overdoses in 2017. The facts on the ground support the conclusion that the situation at the border is a national security. But regardless, President Trump has the authority to define this state of affairs as a national emergency. The National Emergencies Act of 1976 found that 50 U.S.C. 1601 confers unfettered discretion to the president to declare an emergency. And the legislative history supports that conclusion. That means that even if there was some factual basis to claim that the wave of illegal border crossings do not constitute an actual emergency, any lawsuit challenging the president's decision would be asking a court to substitute its judgment for that of a sitting president on a discretionary matter, something most Article III courts refuse to do on justiciability grounds. The views of an Article III court are irrelevant to a national emergency determination under the NEA, a statute that textually commits that decision to the executive and the executive alone. As Professor Jonathan Turley opined in a hearing before the House Judiciary Committee just last month, quote, if Congress cannot muster the votes to rescind the emergency or the supermajority needed to override a veto, it is not the function of the court to compel the same result by the decision of a single jurist, unquote. Simply put, President Trump's emergency declaration and the failure of Congress to override President Trump's veto of the termination resolution are, when considered together, a non-justiciable political question. Second, Congress has lawfully, even if ill-advisedly, delegated the authority to declare this emergency and reprogram unobligated funds already appropriated for military construction projects. Critics of the president, and especially in the news media, have claimed that the president's national emergency declaration is tantamount to a unilateral executive order that spends money that has not been appropriated to fund construction of a border wall in violation of Article 1, Section 9. Where were these reporters the 8 years prior to this administration? But that is incorrect in this case. The declaration cites two specific statutes that provide the president the legal basis to use emergency funds to secure the border. First, the National Emergencies Act, as already mentioned, authorized the president to declare a national emergency. In fact, the legislative history of the NEA reveals that the law, which was originally designed to limit the use of emergency powers, was changed during the legislative process to delegate unfettered authority to presidents making emergency declarations and exercising emergency powers. It's been described this way by some scholars. The law, the NEA, opened the door for the president to walk in, and only the president would decide whether or not he would walk in the door. And then only when he walked in the door did Congress impose limitations on what he could do within the room. 60 national emergencies have been declared since Congress passed the National Emergencies Act in 1976, and 32 are still in effect today. You would think, listening to the hysteria of the national news media, that this is some kind of unprecedented action by this commander-in-chief. Second, 10 U.S. Code 2808 expressly authorizes the president to reprogram existing federal appropriations and access already appropriated but unobligated DOD military construction funds in response to an emergency declaration. This represents explicit statutory authority for the president to direct emergency funding to achieve objectives not otherwise expressly approved by Congress. In this regard, the declaration specifically complies with Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution, because these funds have already been appropriated by Congress. Section 2808 specifically allows the president, quote, to undertake military construction projects not otherwise authorized by law that are necessary to support such use of the armed forces. Now, you may think this an unwise delegation of discretion to the executive. Nevertheless, it is statutorily based. While opponents of the emergency declaration claim that the language to support such use of armed forces limits the president's reprogramming of funds in this case, presidents have deployed the military to the border routinely, and it would be awfully hard to suggest that securing the territorial sovereignty of the nation is not a core function of the military. In fact, President Trump is just the most recent president to use the armed forces to secure the border, having deployed the military to assist our heavily strained border personnel. More than 6,000 troops have been recently deployed to the border. So it would be improbable to suggest that military construction would not support the use of armed forces in this case. Furthermore, it is the president, pursuant to Article II Commander-in-Chief powers, who determines whether and where the armed forces are to be used. So Section 2808 is not a violation of Article I, Section 9, and it does not attempt in contravention of the Constitution to confer legislative power to the executive. Instead, it clarifies how the executive branch may execute a duly enacted appropriations law. And that is the touchstone for determining whether or not an executive order is lawful. Is it authorized by a congressionally enacted law? And in this case, 2808 authorizes the reprogramming. This situation is distinguishable from the precedent in U.S. House of Representatives versus Burwell, in which the House of Representatives succeeded in establishing standing and challenging President Obama's order to pay insurance companies billions of dollars under the Affordable Care Act without an authorization from Congress. President Obama requested money and Congress rejected his request for funds. But unlike President Trump's emergency declaration, President Obama's unilateral effort to order money directly from the Treasury as a permanent appropriation was a clear violation of Article I, Section 9. Conversely, President Trump's emergency declaration and action under 10 U.S. Code 2808 uses already appropriated funds and a specific authorization under federal statute. Some have suggested that if President Trump can use a declaration to build a wall, then a future liberal president could use an executive order to seize guns in violation of the Second Amendment, to levy taxes unilaterally, or to implement the Green New Deal without Congress. But such actions would come with no analogous legal authority, and that is an important distinction. Remember our discussion about Justice Scalia and his embrace of originalism over strict constructionism? Here is where I think it is relevant. Here we must set aside mistrust of all enacted law. We must embrace fair reading textualism and consider the full body of a text. A strict constructionist might try to impose a judicial straitjacket over the delegated power here and argue that a president may never redirect funds appropriated by Congress, or assume that any activity that looks like an appropriation is unconstitutional. But an originalist would see that Congress used broad language to defeat meaningful limitations and intended to grant the president considerable discretion in moving around already appropriated funds to deal with a national emergency. An originalist, as opposed to a strict constructionist, would see that the National Emergencies Act and 2808 confer only executive powers to the president in implementing funds properly appropriated by Congress pursuant to Article I, Section 9. Therefore, even if one believes Congress was ill-advised to do so, the original meaning of Article I, Section 9 does not preclude Congress from giving the president the unfettered discretion to declare an emergency under the National Emergencies Act and reprogramming powers over unobligated funds already appropriated for military construction projects under the Statute 2808. Third, this case is distinguishable from Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company versus Sawyer. Again, I hope Professor Salamanca taught you this case. We all remember this case, the Steel Seizures case. So, my colleague, Adam Schiff, congressman from California, has been in the news a lot recently. He's been in the news a lot about what appears to be his incorrect conclusions on Russian collusion allegations. But I think he was even more wrong about this. Congressman Schiff argued that, quote, if Harry Truman could not nationalize the steel industry during wartime, then this president does not have the power to declare an emergency and build a multi-billion dollar wall on the border, unquote. But President Trump does have that power, because unlike in the Truman case, here, Congress gave it to him. Justice Black ruled in Youngstown that the president lacks inherent emergency powers to act unilaterally without congressional authority, even in wartime. Fair argument. Justice Jackson, in his famous concurring opinion, set forth the proper analysis of these cases. He explained that presidential actions were reviewed along a spectrum of legitimacy with three critical categories. First, a president's actions are largely unassailable when the president acts pursuant to an express or implied authorization from Congress. That, of course, is where the president's power is at its zenith. Second, there are cases where a president acts in areas where Congress is silent, in a so-called zone of twilight. And finally, a president has the least legitimacy when the president takes measures incompatible with the expressed or implied will of Congress. Under such circumstances, his power is at, of course, its lowest ebb. I thought you all were going to join in. You've heard that so many times. So in Youngstown, Truman seized the steel mills without authorization from Congress. In contrast, in this case, President Trump is acting under express authority given to him and all other presidents under the National Emergencies Act. It falls under the first category described by Justice Jackson, where the president's power is at its zenith. So to the extent that Youngstown applies, it works heavily in favor of President Trump. And the fact that a majority of this Congress voted to terminate the emergency declaration is immaterial, since a supermajority vote to terminate is built into the statute's architecture. Fourth, this case is distinguishable from President Obama's DACA-DAPA executive orders. Critics in the media and Democrats complain that those of us who defend President Trump's emergency declaration but opposed President Trump's deferred action for childhood arrivals and deferred action for parents of Americans executive orders have taken inconsistent or hypocritical positions. Nothing could be further from the truth. President Trump's emergency declaration, as has been discussed, was specifically authorized in statute by 2808. This is the literal and exact opposite of President Obama's lawless and unilateral amnesty orders. DACA, DAPA, which unconstitutionally sought to invalidate congressional statutes. President Obama admitted he lacked the statutory authority to change the law unilaterally, but proceeded to do so anyway, violating congressionally enacted laws by effectively awarding lawful presence to those living in the country illegally and granting them affirmative immigration benefits, contravening a variety of clear-cut provisions in the Immigration and Nationality Act. 8 U.S.C. 1101, 1158, 1226, 1229B, 1231, 1325, and 1326. Beyond violating the clear statute, the INA, the entire policy thrust behind DACA and DAPA was to facilitate activity Congress had expressly outlawed, of course, invoking the lowest category in Youngstown. And it was not enough for the Obama administration to defend its actions by arguing it was exercising prosecutorial discretion, which of course allows for prosecutors to exercise discretion on a case-by-case basis. What the Obama executive orders did was suspend the enforcement of the law across a broad-based classification of individuals. That amounts to an attempt by the executive to literally change the law unilaterally without Congress, in violation of the separation of powers, and in a way that is a naked usurpation of the legislative function in Article 1. By contrast, President Trump, in this case, is fulfilling his core Article 2 duties, to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, to enforce duly enacted immigration laws, and prevent foreign nationals from violating those laws on a whole-scale basis. While President Obama could not find a single statute authorizing his administration to issue DACA, DAPA, because none existed, President Trump's emergency declaration is an explicit and straightforward invocation of authority specifically delegated to the President by Congress. Fifth and finally, for those of you who want to reinvigorate the separation of powers, here's your section of the speech. And it's the conclusion of the speech. As Professor Turley pointed out, Congress must either live with the system that it created, or it must change the system. The original version of the National Emergencies Act provided that the president could declare a national emergency, but it would end automatically, absent an affirmative act of Congress within 6 months. It also, the original version, required the president to submit to Congress every 6 months an accounting of the expenditures directly attributable to the exercise of powers and authorities conferred by such a declaration. Therefore, in the original version of this bill, the president had to affirmatively persuade Congress that a national emergency actually existed every 6 months in order to continue to exercise emergency powers. But of course, the bill was amended. It was changed in the course of the legislative process. Excuse me. President Ford had a hand in that. President Ford convinced members of Congress to change the bill. And the final version of the law only provided that Congress could rescind an emergency by a vote of both houses, which inevitably required a supermajority vote of both houses to override a presidential veto, as we recently witnessed, a very high bar indeed. So, for those of you who want to rein in the tyrannical executive branch, for those of you who want to reinvigorate the separation of powers, to restore congressional authority over the power of the purse, to reinvigorate the non-delegation doctrine, Congress need not terminate President Trump's emergency declaration. Rather, and more meaningfully, I would argue, Congress should reverse its policy mistake from 1976 and amend the National Emergencies Act to require, on a prospective basis, an affirmative approval by Congress every 6 months, making it easier for Congress to end a declaration of an emergency, enhancing congressional oversight. Madison indeed said that ambition should be made to counteract ambition. He gave to Congress the tools, but he did not force Congress to always use those tools. Congress, through the National Emergencies Act, may have acceded to presidential ambition, resulting in a policy result I happen to support in this case. But going forward, to advance the separation of powers, to counteract presidential ambition, and to actually carry out Madison's design of each branch zealously guarding its powers, Congress should amend the National Emergencies Act, not deny this president emergency power, but to strengthen Congress's oversight of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/Article I. That's fedsoc.org/Article I.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.